If you will, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. We're going to read this chapter in a minute. While you're doing that, I've been looking forward to coming back for 4 years. I was here for one day to speak 4 years ago and had a marvelous time. And lived in the same place I lived then, Rantoul, Illinois, a couple of hours, 100 miles south of Chicago. And to come back and see old friends is always a tremendous blessing. And I'm looking forward to the studies we're going to have over the next couple of days, talking about the subject of love. And let's read, starting in verse 1 of 1 Corinthians 13. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunts not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoices not in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. Charity never fails, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three. But the greatest of these is charity. After the introductory study tonight from 1 Corinthians 13, I intend to develop the subject of love by going to the prophets. Tomorrow I would like, Lord willing, to speak about the prophet Hosea and the prophet Obadiah. And then on Sunday, I've changed my mind about one thing. On Sunday, the class is going to deal with the prophet of the final week, Zechariah. And then during the sermon Sunday morning, I want to speak on Habakkuk. I don't know why I left that out when I sent the list in, but I want to talk about Habakkuk because he deals with the subject that most makes us doubt the love of God. And then we're going to conclude Sunday evening with Jonah. Hosea is going to tell us about the love of God. Obadiah is going to say something about loving our brother. Zechariah will say something about Christ's love. Habakkuk about the greatest challenge to love. And Jonah loving our enemy. And all of those fall under the heading here of 1 Corinthians 13 and what Paul says about love. Now the reason I want to go to the prophets is because in Matthew 22, when Christ was asked, what's the greatest commandment of the law? He went to Deuteronomy and he went to Leviticus. He went to Deuteronomy 6 and he went to Leviticus 18 and he found two passages that are alike in that they both say, thou shalt love. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love thy neighbor as thyself. And then he said, on these two hang all the law and the prophets. Now, there's a lot in the Old Testament I don't understand. But I do understand that in Matthew 22:40, Christ gave me a key to unlock the meaning of the Old Testament. Everything we're reading in the Law and the Prophets has something to do with the subject of love. Loving God, loving our neighbor, God's love for us. And so I want to use the prophets to illustrate some needed lessons and perspectives on the subject of love. But this evening, I want to begin with this introductory study from the great love chapter in 1 Corinthians and see what Paul has to say about the subject here. Now, the very last verse of chapter 12, Paul says to this church, I'm going to show you a more excellent way. they had lost their way. The Corinthian church was way off. And it was important that they be brought back to where they ought to be. In regard to preachers, they had preacheritis. They were suing one another. They were maintaining fellowship with people committing sins that not even the Gentiles wanted to have anything to do with. Now, when the Gentiles don't want to be messed up in a sin, that's pretty bad. They were making a mockery of the Lord's Supper. They were abusing their liberties. They were misusing spiritual gifts. They were mixed up on the resurrection, on and on. And I believe in verse 13, when Paul says, "I want to show you the more excellent way," he is getting to the most important thing that the Corinthians or we can talk about, and that's this subject of love. I want to divide chapter 13 into three paragraphs. And these will be the three points of our study tonight. In the first three verses, Paul talks about the priority of love. In verses 4 through 8, he talks about the properties of love. And then in verses 9 through 13, he talks about the permanence of love. And what Paul says here is that there are some things that as a Christian, you don't necessarily need. Not every Corinthian had every spiritual gift, and I'm sure there were some Corinthians who had no spiritual gift. There are things in this world that we can get through life just fine, and we don't need them in order to be a Christian. You don't need to know how to speak Greek or read Greek to be a Christian. But there is one thing that if we don't have it, we cannot be a Christian, and that's this business of love. Well, we're studying 1 John in one of our classes on Sunday morning at home. And the interesting thing about 1 John is that he recycles three topics several times through in the book. He wrote 1 John 5:13 tells us that we might know that we're in fellowship with Christ, that we can know that we have eternal life. The Gospel of John was written that we might have life, John 20, 30, and 31. The first epistle of John was written to tell us how we can know that we have that life, chapter 5, verse 13. And the book of Revelation was written by John to say, now once you've got this life, don't lose it. Be faithful unto death. Hang in there. But in 1 John, he cycles through three subjects as being the identifying marks of the one who is in fellowship with God, who has eternal life. And those three topics are belief, obedience, and love. And lacking any one of those three, we're going to be off in our attempt to be in fellowship with God. And of those three, the most important, far and away, of course, is this matter of love. We can believe the right things. This is the problem with creeds. You know, a creed is a statement in which you say, here's what I believe. Folks, it's possible to believe the right thing, to have the right answer to every question that someone might ask us about religion, spirituality, the Bible. We can have the right answer to every question. If we have not love, we are not right with God. And Paul makes that clear here to the Corinthians. And so I want to look at these three paragraphs tonight and try to say something that I hope is helpful about each one. So let's go back to the first three verses and see what he says about the priority of love. Paul is going to contrast the things they had been going after, the things they had been pursuing, the things they wanted, with the thing they should have wanted, with the thing they should have had. And in the first three verses, he mentions five things. He starts out in verse 1 by talking about tongues. And I'm not sure if that refers to being bilingual or being multilingual. If you had the gift of tongues, you could speak another language. When I go overseas, I just am envious of people who are fluent in French. I never even studied English in grade school. I never thought I'd go to England. I like people who can speak English the way they speak it over there. So maybe Paul is talking about those who have this miraculous gift of speaking in some other language. He may be talking about the gift of eloquence, being an orator, to speak in the tongues of an angel. Paul says it doesn't matter what your second language is. It doesn't matter how fluent you are in it. If you have not love, you're nothing, doing nothing but banging a gong. Have you ever been to a gong concert? If there was going to be one around here, I'd do everything I could to avoid it. I think after a few minutes, a gong, gong, I'd have a splitting headache. Paul says that's all you're doing when you speak, no matter how well you do it. All you're doing is clang, clang, clang goes the trolley. And then he talks about prophecy and knowledge and faith. To prophesy, that was one of the channels of revelation by which God's word was given. To have knowledge, to be an intellectual, to be brainy. There are people who go after that with everything they've got. The gift of faith. Faith here, I think, refers to the ability to deal with any problem that comes your way. Christ would illustrate faith by saying, if you've got faith like a grain of mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, get out of here and go into the sea. There is no problem that you encounter that cannot be dealt with that can be dealt with by faith. But Paul says, without love, all of that knowledge, even being used by God as a channel of revelation. Sometimes God used people as a means of revealing His will, and those people weren't hardly fit to be around because they didn't have love. Or to have that great gift of faith where you can deal with problems, that's not enough. And then he talks about service. The four things where you give all your goods to feed the poor. Christ told a rich young ruler, sell what you've got, give all of it to the poor, and come and follow me. Here are people who have done that very thing. And Paul says, without love, that's nothing. But what about sacrifice? What about martyrdom? There have been times in history where martyrdom has become fashionable. I think it's fashionable in the Islamic world right now, where that's the thing to do. And we often identify those kind of people with fanaticism, someone who really believes their faith and are willing to die for it. Paul says, without love, not even martyrdom counts for anything. Now I want to tell you something. A good that we do, and giving our goods to people who are in need, that's a good thing. Being able to deal with problems that come our way, that's a good thing. Having the right answers, knowledge, that's a good thing. Any good that we might do that is not done out of love is no good at all. Everything is nothing apart from love. In the kingdom, the great things are useless without love. And what are those things? Well, eloquence, prophecy, knowledge, service, sacrifice, faith. And yet those are the things we seem to praise people the most for. In the town I live in, they're looking for a preacher now. This isn't the town where I preach, but the town I live in. The church there is looking for a preacher. And a friend of mine who's been on the committee to find a preacher got a hold of me a few months ago. He wanted to have lunch. And we got together and he said, what do you think we should look for in a preacher? I said, love. And he kind of looked at me and blinked his eyes. I said, does anybody ask any of these guys you're talking to if they love the Lord and love their brother? Do they love their enemy? Do they love their neighbor? That wasn't the answer he was wanting me to give him. And the fact that when we look for someone to preach for us and we don't ask that question, but we ask about the other things, how eloquent are they, how knowledgeable, that just tells me we don't really believe our Bible. When the Bible says the most important thing is love, that's the priority. And Paul leaves us in no doubt about that as he opens this 13th chapter. Now, with that said, let's go to the next paragraph where he talks about the properties of love. Now, by my count, there are 16 that he mentions. He runs love through a spiritual prism, so to speak, and that white light of love is broken into its constituent elements. And there are 16. Now let me suggest three things you might do with this list of 16. The first thing is to insert the word God every place you see the word love or charity in the King James. Love is long-suffering. God is long-suffering. God is kind. God bears all things. God believes. You know, just go through that list. If A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. God is love, the Bible tells us. And so God is these 16 things. Then after you've put God's name in there in place of the word love, put your name in there. And that's where I get really nervous, because when my name's in there, I just see so many areas where whatever statement is being made could not be made of me. And then if you think any of these are unimportant, which of these 16 could be deleted and we still have the hope of salvation? I mean, if God lacked any one of these 16, what chance would any of us have? That's why I say these 16 are a composite picture of what love is. All of them are important. Now, God, of course, has them in the perfect degree. We don't. We're works in progress. But we cannot neglect any of these 16 and still come to have the type of love that Paul's talking about, that God expects us to have. Now, let's go through this list and see what Paul says about love and what insights we can gain into this from what he says. The first one is that love suffers long. I like that translation better than long-suffering, like many versions have it. Love suffers long. Now, that's got to jolt people, especially if you've ever been to see the movie Love Story. When I was a senior in high school, I borrowed my Uncle Bill's 1968 Plymouth Fury and took Corrine Knutson to see Love Story. The only thing I remember from that show is love means never having to say you're sorry. I thought that was dumb then. I still think that's dumb. If you're a human being, there's going to be lots of times in your life when you're going to have to say to someone, I'm sorry. But what's even tougher is when you're the one being apologized to. When your feelings have been hurt. When your trust has been betrayed. When you've been left hanging because someone pulled the rug out from under your feet, and then they come and want to smooth everything over and get back to the way things were simply by saying, I'm sorry, I apologize, I was wrong, will you forgive me? That's when love's suffering becomes obvious. And we're going to talk about that from Hosea tomorrow. That's one of the big lessons that we learn about love from the prophet Hosea. The reason love suffers is because we're dealing with sinful human beings. We are dealing with flawed people. And that's why when I do marriage counseling, one of the things I emphasize is that when you bring two sinners and put them together, expect problems. And you better be mentally, emotionally prepared, spiritually prepared for the problems that are going to come, because problems are going to come. And if you're unwilling to suffer, sometimes through long years, as the other works on those problems, and as you deal with that situation, then you're not ready to get married. You're not ready for any relationship unless you're willing to accept the suffering that comes. Love suffers long. And love is kind. I heard about a little girl who prayed, Lord, make the bad people good and the good people kind. Have you ever been around some good person who wants to tell you what a pain in the neck you are for them to be good to you? For them to be nice to you? Oh, they're going to be nice to you. They're going to do the right thing. But boy, you're really making it hard on them. Love is kind. One time I heard Bob Owen introduce a preacher by saying he was a sweet man. And I was fairly young when I heard Bob say this. And I remember sitting out there thinking, I hope Bob never introduces me that way. But the older I've gotten, the more I've appreciated what it means to be a sweet and gentle spirit. And that's what's wrapped up in this word, kind. To have a graciousness about us. That even when we're suffering, even when we're hurting, that we can still be kind to people. Love doesn't envy. The word envy is very closely related to the word jealousy. It doesn't want what another has. It isn't possessive. It isn't controlling. If there's one thing I've learned about love in this life, it is that you cannot force another person to love you. You cannot pull the strings. You can't stack the deck. You can't control them to where they love you whether they want it or not. Have you ever had a friend who didn't want you to have another friend? Some of you know about J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Tolkien was instrumental in bringing C.S. Lewis to belief. And they were very close friends at one point, but as Lewis became well known through his own writings, and really became better known than Tolkien back in the 30s and 40s, Tolkien became very jealous of the people that Lewis became friends with, spent time with, hung out with, and it really put a cloud over their relationship. Love isn't that way. Love doesn't try to smother something in possessiveness. And it's not upset, envious, when the one loved forms good relationships with others. Love doesn't vaunt itself. Now that's what the Pharisees were good at doing. Christ said it in Matthew chapter 6. Before they would pull some money out of their wallet to help out a poor person, they'd get out their horn and blow it. Before they'd pray, they would go to a conspicuous place so everybody could see and hear. When they fasted, they let their beard grow, they didn't brush their teeth, they didn't wash their face. They wanted everyone to know they were engaged in some religious activity. Love doesn't do that. Love's not puffed up. It's not inflated. Now that's what knowledge does. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 8 verse 1 that knowledge puffs up, love builds up. Love doesn't have a sense of its own self-importance and parade it and expect other people to acknowledge it and to bow down to it. Love does not behave itself unruly. It isn't rude. Listen, if something you're doing, snapping your gum or whatever, irritates someone, if you love that person, stop it. You can. Figure out some other habit that's less irritable to them. Love is not rude. Love has good manners. It does not behave itself in an unseemly way. And love seeks not her own. It isn't competitive. It isn't selfish. Love doesn't look at a situation and ask, now what can I get out of this? Love looks at a situation and asks, what am I going to put into this? It doesn't ask, what can another do for me? It asks, what can I do for the other? Love does not seek its own. It seeks the benefit of the one loved. And we'll talk about that a lot when we talk about Jonah Sunday night. Love is not easily provoked. Are you thin-skinned? You know anybody who's thin-skinned? You know anybody who's touchy? You know anybody that you've got to walk on eggshells when you're around them for fear that you might say something, that you might do something that just sets them off? Well, love isn't that way. You know what? You can tell a lover anything. You don't have to think 30 minutes before you form a sentence that you speak in the presence of a lover. When you're talking to a lover, even if it doesn't come out right, because they have the qualities we're talking about here, they can deal with that. They can process it and handle it. Love is not easily provoked. Love thinks no evil. And I like the way one translation, maybe J.B. Phillips, who translates it this way, love does not keep a scorecard. I've kept scorecards in my life. Somebody has wronged me, somebody has hurt me, or hurt someone I love. And I've got that scorecard right there in the back pocket, and it shows what the score is. But they've hurt me, I've not hurt them. And I never kept a scorecard because I was going to one day even the score. Let me at least say that in my own defense. I was never looking to even the score, but I would pull that scorecard out ever so often and just use it to refresh my anger or the fact that I was upset or to remind me why I wasn't talking to them anymore or I wouldn't do anything with them. And somewhere along the line, I decided to tear that scorecard up. And I don't have a scorecard now, but I have more friends than I used to have. And cords that were broken vibrate once more in relationship because I got rid of a scorecard. Love does not rejoice in iniquity. It doesn't gloat. I can remember where I was the day Kennedy was shot. I was in a study hall in the old Ludlow High School. I was only in fifth grade. But we were in the old high school building, the kind that had the slide for the fire escape. Remember those? Big thing once a year was getting to practice the fire escape going down the slide. I remember Mr. Delk came in. He was the eighth grade teacher. Mr. Delk called me last night. He's 91 years old now. He retired from teaching last year. The last 21 years of his life here, he's been teaching junior college down in Chattanooga, Tennessee. 2 years ago, I went down and sat in one of his classes. Now, it's not many people who can sit in a class when they're in fifth grade and then 45 years later sit in a class with the same teacher. But I was able to do that. And I chewed gum 2 years ago in class when I was there. I couldn't have gotten away with that in fifth grade. But Mr. Delk came in and said Kennedy had been shot and there was a boy in class who started clapping. Now we sometimes do that in our spirit. When we hear that misfortune has befallen someone, we're just kind of happy they got it. But love doesn't react that way. It does not rejoice in iniquity. That's so easy to do when you're dealing with an enemy. But love doesn't do that. Love rejoices in truth. To think that you can't be tough with someone you love is not biblical. To think that you can't speak the truth if you're afraid the truth is going to hurt someone's feelings is not biblical. There is no value gained in telling a lie, in perpetuating a lie, in encouraging someone to think that which is not true. Love deals in truth. Now, love knows how to speak truth in a way that doesn't create a prejudice against the truth. But if telling the truth upsets, if telling the truth in a loving way upsets someone, then that person is just going to have to be upset. One time the disciples came to Christ and said, "Oh, you have upset the Pharisees." And Christ did not say, "Oh, no. Listen, we've got to get out the spin doctors and we've got to gloss this over and smooth this over so that these people will understand I didn't really mean what I meant when I said it." Now, he said, "Listen, they're blind guys. They're leaders of the blind. Let them alone." If telling the truth in a loving way upsets someone, they're just going to have to be upset. Love rejoices in truth. Love bears all things. Moffat, in his translation, says this: "Love is slow to expose." I love that. Love is slow to expose. Many, many years ago, we had a widow in the congregation who married a widower from a church in Indiana. And they were going to live in the town where I was. And about the time they got married and were relocating to my hometown, I got a call from the preacher over in Indiana where the widower attended church. And the purpose of the call was to fill me in on this brother. Apparently when his wife died, he went a little haywire or something. I think he may have set fire to their trailer and tried to collect the insurance money or something. I didn't need to know that. He never once in all the years I knew him, he's dead now, he never once showed anything even close to that in his behavior. But the preacher over there didn't like him for some reason, and so without him knowing it, he was just going to stick it to him a little bit by telling me what had happened. Love is slow to expose. It's not looking to embarrass. It's not looking to humiliate. And it's willing to hold and play close to the best information that does nobody any good in putting it out. Love believes all things. It's trusting. It believes the best. Love hopes all things. Now let me tell you something here that's always bothered me just a bit. I said a few minutes ago, take love out, put God in. God is long-suffering. God is kind. Now, I have no problem with all of that, but when I read this, God hopes all things. How can an omniscient being hope? And I'm not sure I figured that out. But I think there must be something about God that even when He knows how something's going to turn out, He yet has that quality in Him that wants it to be better. Remember the story of Ahab and Naboth, when Ahab wanted Naboth's vineyard and Jezebel helped Ahab figure out how to get it by framing Naboth, having him killed, and then confiscating his vineyard. And God sends Elijah, "You go tell Ahab he's dog meat. And his wife is dog meat." And Elijah went in and told him that. And when Ahab heard that, for a moment there, he humbled himself. For a moment he was on his knees. For a moment the arrogance and the pride was gone. And it was God who said, "Elijah, would you look at that? Who would have thought it? I tell you what, go back and tell Ahab that I'm not going to make it happen like I said I would." Because of the way he's humbled himself now. And I think Christ in his dealings with Judas knowing from the start what Judas would end up doing. Yet throughout that final few hours there before the betrayal, he keeps appealing to Judas, sometimes in ways that we've missed, but again and again and again, he is giving Judas an out. He's saying, Judas, you don't have to go through with this. I really don't know how an omniscient being can hope, but I believe God has shown us instances where He's expressing what we would understand as hope. Listen, so long as you're not in hell, there's hope. Love endures all things. Tomorrow when we look at Hosea, or maybe it's Obadiah, when we look at Obadiah, is love willing to endure the blame when you're not to blame? When you're innocent? Is love willing to endure the blame? It endures all things. We'll talk about that with Obadiah tomorrow. Verse 8 says that love never fails. Now, I fail a lot. And when I fail, it's because I'm lacking in love somehow. With love, there's no such thing as failure. Now, there may not be success, but there's no failure where there is love. And then in the last paragraph, Paul talks about the permanence of love. And the way we have, in our fellowship, in our tradition, the way we have normally interpreted this passage, certainly the way I have in the past, is to say that Paul is here talking about the completion of the Bible. When that which is perfect is come, which we have taken, and maybe you haven't, I'm just speaking out of my own experience, understand. But when that which is perfect is come, we've taken to mean when the Bible is complete, when all the books have been written and gathered together, collected together into one volume, when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part, these spiritual gifts, shall vanish away. And there's no denying the fact that spiritual gifts have vanished away. But I've got just a bit of a problem with that interpretation. And that may be the right explanation. I'm not saying it isn't. But here's the problem I have with it. The problem is, Paul's not been talking about the writing of the Bible. I believe the Corinthian church had all the information the Corinthian church needed that was provided by those spiritual gifts, the gift of knowledge and the gift of prophecy and the gift of faith and the gift of discernment, the gift of wisdom. They had all the knowledge they needed. If you had brought a truckload of books, of Bibles to Corinth, and everyone had a Bible in their hand and a Bible in the pew, Corinth would have still been a mess because it lacked love. And it may be, and I'm just throwing this out for your own thinking, in the context here, it may be that the perfect to which Paul refers is love. Only when they come to that point will they have a clear vision of God, will they have a clear grasp of Him. So long as they are unloving, their knowledge is incomplete, it's partial. The prophecy, the revelation that's been delivered in Corinth is not achieving that for which it was delivered. And it's only when they would come to love that the perfect really would have arrived. Now, just think about that. Go back and look at the context. I will say this. In verse 12, for now we see through a glass darkly, through a mirror. You know, and their mirrors were made out of bronze or metal that they would polish up. And sometimes didn't give a real good reflection, but now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. Then shall I know even as I am known. Now turn back to chapter 8 and look at verse 3. How does God know? On what basis does God know an individual? 1 Corinthians 8, verse 13, but if any man love God, the same is known of him. If perfect refers to love, when we live by love, when we walk in love, when we show love to God, to our neighbor, to our enemy, to our brother, then God is known from the basis of love the way He knows us from the basis of love. God doesn't remember my name because of any schooling I've gotten. God doesn't remember my name because of any amount I put in the collection plate. God doesn't remember my name because of anybody I've helped. If God knows my name at all, if He knows me at all, it's because of the love that I exemplify in my life. Those are the people God knows. So, that being the case, we need to learn something about what it means to love God, to love our neighbor. Lord willing, tomorrow we'll start with Hosea and we'll get into this. Browning said, Jesus Christ was the most honest man he ever met. When his friends were saying, Browning, you're the greatest,